Hi, Cardinal fans. I'm Ozzie Smith.
Smith corks one into right down the line. It may go.
And you're listening to the Cardinals Insider Podcast.
Go crazy, folks. Go crazy.
Here's your host, Brett McMillan.
Cardinals Insider Podcast for May the 8th, 2018. We're just fresh off the Kentucky Derby this past weekend as I speak. And I'm not a huge horse racing guy, but I think there's something called a trifecta. Well, I feel like we've got a Cardinals trifecta going on as we come out of this past weekend. Redbirds are in first place as I speak right now on the 7th of May when I record this, up a game and a half. Just swept the Cubbies right on out of Busch Stadium, walk-off fashion in a couple of those games. And it's also a beautiful, sunshiny day as we get ready to welcome in the Minnesota Twins as I speak to you. So I hope that those conditions are all still similar by the time that you listen to this. Welcome to the program. My name is Brett McMillan. We have a diverse and, I would like to think, quite rich podcast for you today. In a little bit, Ben Holtmeyer and Stan McNeil going to talk about the newest, I believe it's the cover feature actually, but at least a story that appears in the newest Cardinals magazine on Bob Gibson as we celebrate the 50-year anniversary of that historic 1968 season. And in just a few moments, I'm going to play a conversation that I had with a gentleman named Jim Shealy. You might not be familiar with him, but I've got to tell you, he has got some awesome stories about the Cardinals. He has been attending games in person since 1936. So Jim is a wealth of knowledge and experiences when it comes to Cardinal baseball. I'm a baseball geek and a Cardinal geek, and I always think that I would have loved to have seen the great teams of the 40s and the 60s and the 30s, you know, as well as any other Cardinal team, really, that's been great. But those teams in particular, I just think it would have been fun to have seen him play in person. Jim did. So he joins the podcast, and he tells us about the grand tradition that is Cardinal baseball and the way that he has watched it over the past few decades unfold. So Jim, coming up in just a minute. Speaking of grand traditions, there's one in college sports in this part of the country. Is it ILL or MIZ for you? Cheer on the Cards in your favorite school on Friday, May the 18th. It's Bragging Rights Night presented by Fox Sports Midwest. With the purchase of a special theme ticket, fans receive a Mizzou or Illini-themed mesh Cardinals jersey. Get your tickets now at cardinals.com/theme. So as I mentioned at the top, Jim Shealy is the guest today, the main guest on the podcast, and his family, or the company that they own, I suppose, has been in the same seats since 1942, and Jim himself has been coming to Cardinal games at Sportsman's Park, and then at Busch 2, and now here at Busch 3. He's been coming since 1936. It was a treat for me to get together and talk with him, a longtime season ticket holder. We appreciate him being part of the Cardinal family. I wanted somebody with these great stories. I reached out to the folks at Season Tickets because I figured it would be someone that they do business with, and they said, yeah, this is the guy. If you want to talk to someone from Sportsman's Park that experienced games in person, Jim is your man, and he did not disappoint. So here it is. Without further ado, we'll be back in just a second to our Busch Stadium press box level studios, but for now, enjoy myself and Jim Shealy, longtime Cardinal fan, on the Cardinals Insider Podcast. As we promised at the top, Jim Shealy, he has been a Cardinals season ticket holder for decades and decades, and he has seen a lot of Cardinal history in his day, dating all the way back to Sportsman's Park. And I get a lot of questions about Sportsman's Park, folks wanting to know what it was like, and a lot of us who never got to see a game there, I think, really wish that we could have. So, Jim, you are the guy that has all the answers. It's good to have you with us today. Thanks for making time for us.
I'm very pleased to be here. I'm honored to be here, and I probably don't have all of the recollection that we'd like, but enough.
Well, I've already talked to you a little bit here before we jumped on, and it sounds like your history going to games goes back to 1936, and you've been a season ticket holder since 1942. Is that correct?
Well, actually, the family corporation and or members of the family were season ticket holders going back into the 1930s. But we have had the same seats at three different Cardinal ballparks since 1942. So our seats, which are between third and home, three rows up. Now the visitors' dugout is just to the left of us. That's been the location that we've had in three different stadiums.
Well, when I think about 1942, you know what comes to my mind, I bet that you will, is that that is the first full year that Stan Musial was a St. Louis Cardinal. I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask if you remembered watching him play.
Yes, well, I can go a little bit further on that, Brett, if you'd like.
Please do.
I saw Stan play in his very first game here in St. Louis at Sportsman's Park, of course, in September of 1941 when they brought him up. And the guy who was really had more publicity was Irv Dusak, and because he was a power hitter. And so his nickname was Forsack Dusak. But they liked Stan a lot, the organization did, because I think in that September he hit something like 400.
Not too bad.
And they brought up, so in the following season then, in 1942, they brought up both Dusak and Stan Musial, and I guess the rest is history. I don't remember how long the other guy lasted, but as far as I'm concerned, Stan's still out there.
You have a favorite memory from, I mean, you watched his whole career, essentially.
Yes.
Do you have a favorite game that you watched him play?
Well, there were so many, but the one that sticks in my head was the last game that he played. And so I'm just pleased to say that I watched him in his very, very first game in September of 41, and I watched him in his last game, which was the season that he retired. But Stan went out like he came in. I think he had two hits. And then the manager took him off the field. And, of course, that's a moment that I would never forget.
Now, we're sitting right here just to give people a picture of where we are. We're in the writer's press box, which is that big Budweiser sign inside the bowl of Busch Stadium. And as we look out, it's a day where the team is away, but there's ribbon boards and signage everywhere. And three ballparks removed from Sportsman's Park, I imagine that this is a very different, still fun, equally enjoyable, I'm sure, but a very different game experience than you would have experienced as a young man.
That is correct, Brett. And I can tell you why it's different and what the huge difference is. Sportsman's Park, like Wrigley Field, is historic. I was most of the time privileged to sit in a very good box seat, although I sat with the Gas House gang too, up in the bleachers. But the difference between this stadium, as far as seeing the ball game for all the fans that are here, the difference between this stadium and Sportsman's Park is monumental. I'm pleased to say I was at Sportsman's Park, but for the majority of the fans going to games in those times and now, difference is just gigantic. There isn't a bad seat in this ballpark. It's wonderful. And most of the seats at Sportsman's Park, I'll put this very gently, were not very good.
They had the poles, kind of like Wrigley nowadays.
Yes.
There's just a pole sitting in the middle of a section.
And Wrigley even has, I would say, has a little heads up over the old Sportsman's Park. A lot of the seats were faced so that you had to turn your head in order to see the game. And as you suggested, many seats were behind the steel girders. And then there were a lot of other inconveniences that I could name, but it was not a comfortable place for most of the fans.
It was a kind of a unique ballpark, a neighborhood ballpark like so many were back then, and like Wrigley or Fenway is still now. But what are the distinguishing marks, you know, of that ballpark, the character, I suppose, that you remember from seeing games there?
Well, to begin with, it was, in essence, a neighborhood-type ballpark. And right in the middle of St. Louis on Grand and Dodier. And really, for its time, I'm going to say, a nice place to be for those times. I'm talking back in the 30s and in the 40s. But characteristically being built, I think it was sometime after, during or after World War I, it had all, let's say it had all the gracious earmarks of that long past era. So I guess you can think of it in that way.
Do you remember riding, I know a lot of people did, or at least I've always heard so, riding the streetcar to the game. Was that something you did when you were growing up?
Many times.
What was that like?
Well, the streetcars were a very important, along with the buses, were a very important transportation feature of the city, which, as you know, at that time was three-quarters of a million people. And it's simply how most of us got around. There really weren't parking lots that I recall. There weren't too many of them around the old Sportsman Park. You parked in the neighborhood, and some of the people rented out space at their houses that you could park during a game. But riding the streetcar was just to the games, pretty ordinary thing to do. As a matter of fact, the time I remember best was the last game that the old St. Louis Browns played in 1944, where they clinched the pennant. And so I distinctly remember at that time riding the streetcar to and from the game that day, and I can tell you it was wild.
1944, the Cardinals and the Browns in the World Series, you just referenced it. Our city really has never seen anything quite like that ever since, obviously, now being a one-team town as far as baseball goes. The whole baseball world was looking at St. Louis in the fall of 1944. What was the city like that fall, Jim, with those two teams squaring off all of the games played at Sportsman's Park?
Well, it was a unique time, one that the city can be proud of, and I'm going to say the fans were wonderful. Like I was, I think many people that came out were both Cards and Browns fans. Because of the nature of the teams over the years, the Cardinals were the favorites, really, fan favorites. But people were proud, again, to have both teams play. And it was a magnificent series. It was 4-2, as I recall, Cards won, but the Browns made it very, very close.
Do you have a favorite team that you watched from those, I guess, 40s, 50s, and 60s? There was a lot of great characters those decades of Cardinal baseball. There was some great winning teams, and most of us, again, you know, didn't have the privilege to watch them play in person. But tell me, did you have a favorite year or a favorite team
during those early days?
Yeah, the 30s, 40s, and 50s, yeah. And 60s.
Well, I can tell you, I picked up on the remnants of the Gas House Gang of 34 because, as I mentioned previously, started going to games in 1936. So the likes of Pepper Martin, Leo DeRocher, and Dizzy Dean, and I saw all three of those people play. That will forever resonate in my mind of thoroughly great athletes to watch, exciting, and darn good ball players, I might say, each one. Leo was always a favorite of mine.
when I think of Dizzy Dean, that name that you brought up, I kind of think of this bombastic personality, certainly the skill as a ball player. And I think that most people listening to this probably saw Al Hrabowski play and think about his energy on the mound, and maybe that's the closest thing they could equate to Dizzy. But what was he like when you would watch him? Did he come across, even from, you know, yards away, but did he come across as kind of that swagger that we all hear about now?
No, you put it very well. I couldn't describe Dizzy better. Confidence, I think that's before the word was invented. He had it. And swagger, yes, always. And the high kick, and always with the idea in his head that he was going to win that game. And, of course, pitchers back in those days went nine.
Yeah, they went nine.
A lot of the time. And they didn't make pitch counts known at that time. But I'm going to suggest that on a hot day, on a hot summer Sunday afternoon doubleheader, it was not unusual for a pitcher to go nine innings. And pitch count was probably 140 or 150. Didn't make any difference. In a St. Louis summer, those guys were conditioned to do it.
Dizzy was one of the first professional athletes, and now we see it all the time today, but in his day, it really wasn't done that much where they would endorse products. Do you remember Dizzy endorsing products and seeing his likeness across the city in those days?
No, I don't recall any of that. Of course, then he became a fantastic baseball announcer, and whichever beer company or companies he was touting then, I can tell you the people probably bought that beer because he was a great personal salesman.
Do you have a favorite game, I guess, from Sportsman's Park? Maybe in the playoffs? You saw 44 in the World Series. Did you see any of those other great Cardinal teams in the 40s or maybe in 64?
Well, I think maybe, just right off the top, the 46 World Series, Red Sox, Cards, went seven, but the chance to see Ted Williams play was, I knew it was a privilege. I was at least smart enough then to know it was a privilege to watch that guy. Plus the players we had on our team, of course, it was Stan and Slaughter and Terry Moore. And it was pretty hard to replicate that kind of lineup.
You've seen arguably probably the vast majority of the great Cardinals of all time play. Do you have a favorite Cardinal player?
Three.
Well, let me hear them. I'd love to hear them.
Three. Well, actually, I can go three tiers, but I won't take up your time by doing that. But my top three, no particular order, Slaughter, Musial, and Willie McGee. Now, I did think about this for a bit, and I believe my second tier was Pepper Martin, Dizzy Dean, and Bob Gibson. And then it goes on. My gosh, there's so many great players that have been through these parts.
What is it that endeared you to Willie McGee? I think that's an interesting one, and we love Willie, and he's a Cardinal Hall of Famer, and a lot of people that are, you know, contemporary fans, I suppose, remember, you know, Willie, but having the chance to compare him to those other names that you mentioned, yet still he's a favorite. How come?
I loved watching Willie McGee from the very first game that he played here. I liked his style. I like his ability. I like his modesty. He could do everything that Leo DeRocher always characterized as being a great ball player. He could hit. He could hit for power, he could throw, he could run. Those are the essential things. And I just love watching the guy trot out to center field. Everything about him. And I am so pleased that he is here with us now. And I don't really collect autographs, although I have a few pretty darn good autographs. But I think the biggest kick I had was getting Willie McGee's autograph, right behind getting Willie Mays' autograph. That was a pretty big deal, too.
Do you remember the circumstances around that? What the circumstances of getting Willie Mays' autograph were?
Yes. Waited in line. I think it was at the Holiday Inn out at or near the airport. And waiting in line for an hour and a half. And the other guy who was autographing that day was Leo DeRocher. And I was hoping maybe I would make that, but Leo left early. But I did have the opportunity to shake Willie Mays' hand, which you're not supposed to do, of course, and talk to him for, I guess, all of 30 seconds, which to me was a great big deal, and having his autograph. And I might say, I'll get you a copy of this picture if you'd like to have one. But in the 1958, I think it was the 58 All-Star game that was here in St. Louis. It was either 57 or 58. I think it was 58. Right down by our then box, which was the right next to the National League dugout. I have a picture autographed both by Willie Mays and Hank Aaron.
Wow.
Coming back into the dugout together. I'll get you a copy of that.
That's a tremendous sounding photo right there. Some amazing, amazing names that you have seen in your years as a Cardinal fan attending games here in St. Louis. And a topic that I always find to be interesting is the way that the franchise transitioned from playing out at Grand and Dodier at what was Sportsman's Park to Busch II, which technically really was named Busch Memorial Stadium here in downtown St. Louis. The year was 1966. And unlike the opening of Busch III, which we're sitting in now, and the one that most fans probably remember the transition, it was not a clean break from one season to another. It was, I want to say, in May that they had a ceremony where they flew home plate from one ballpark to another, and I hear tell that you were there. Can you tell me about that day?
Well, I was at opening day for that stadium. And yes, there was a lot of ceremony, but somehow in my head it just comes back as another Cardinal game. It was more exciting to watch the Cardinals, I think. Who in that stretch during the 1960s had some really fine ball clubs under Albert Red Cheney's.
Who did you enjoy watching in the 60s? Because you're right, boy, was there, just like the 40s, there was a long list of all-time great names on those clubs.
Yeah, there was. Well, I think the two guys that really stand out, the three guys that stand out, were Gibson, Mike Shannon, and Tim McCarver. And there wasn't anything like Gibson. There'll never be another Gibby. As you remember, the year following his greatest year, they lowered the pitcher's mound in order to accommodate the hitters. The guy was not as good as advertised. He was better. And when you talk about two-way ball players, on the days he wasn't pitching, he knew how to hit, and he knew how to field. He could have played every day.
Now, he had a home run in Game 7 of the 67 World Series out in Boston. He had he was a great hitting pitcher.
Right. Yeah, he was. But watching McCarver and Gibson, that battery was one of the most exciting. And I recall very well that when Gibby pitched, McCarver caught, Maxville played short, and of course Kurt Flood held down center field. That was pretty tough. That was straight down the middle. That was pretty tough to beat.
I'd say so. You mentioned Red, who you have seen basically, well, not basically, you have seen his entire existence as a St. Louis Cardinal. He came up in 1946 with the big club. What's that been like to see Red go from the young redheaded second baseman to a Hall of Famer to a manager winning a World Series and now a gentleman that we still treasure very much here at Busch Stadium and has remained engaged with the franchise in this season of his life too? What's your thing you've enjoyed the most, I guess, about watching Red through the years?
Well, his consistency, his knowledge of the game, which is what Red always appeared to be, a very low-key manager. I don't know what he talked about in the dugout or the locker room, but just his general appearance was of being pretty low-key. He wasn't yelling and screaming as some managers are prone to do. He knew the game. He knew how to treat his ball players. They all loved him and respected him. And my only thoughts right now are God bless Red Shandies.
Jim, I think there's a question a lot of people who are listening probably are thinking to themselves, and I'll ask it now, which is that, you know, we all love Cardinal baseball, and you have kept season tickets as part of your family's tradition for decades and decades and
right.
decades. You know, obviously the easy answer is because it's fun to come to the ball game. But for you all as a family, why has it been important to you to have those seats over the years and to really have Cardinal baseball be a part of what you all do on a summer-to-summer basis?
Well, you can't do everything in life. But one thing that I learned way back, that first season that I started coming to ball games, which was in 1936, is this is the real deal. And as long as I'm standing and walking around, I'm going to be out at that ballpark. It's it goes beyond tradition. It becomes, at least I can tell you as a St. Louis ball fan, 80 years, 81 years now, I think this is my 81st year of watching Cardinal baseball, that it's part of life. It's part of what you think. It's part of what you talk about. It's part of what you do. And so it goes far beyond just one more interesting sport. I don't think there's there is no other professional sport just exactly like it.
What do you remember most about those Gas House gang teams? I guess, you know, you said that was kind of when your fanship was coming along. You attached yourselves to those players, and of course 36 was a little bit after the gang was kind of at its zenith. But what was the thing that defined that group to you?
I think it was the spirit that those guys generated themselves. Now, of course, a lot of this, even back in those times, was possibly myth, but what we were told or read was that it wasn't unusual for those guys to get in fights after or before the game. And if someone made a bad play in the outfield, let's say, the guy sitting next to him in the dugout would let him know about it. And, you know, there were no polite exchanges. All of that could be somewhat exaggerating, but I'm going to tell you, those guys were tough. Pepper Martin was as tough a ball player, as tough an athlete as I've ever seen. He was exciting to watch. He played third base. I'm going to exaggerate and say about half the balls that came to him bounced off of his chest before he threw the runner out, because a lot of times that was the only way he knew how to stop a line drive or a hard hit ground ball. But it was that kind of image that they projected. DeRocher was tough, and he was also smart, and he was a very, very smart manager, maybe one of my favorite of all times, because he was creative, great intuition into the game. But those guys again, along with Dizzy and his brother, and then, my gosh, followed right up by Eno Slaughter, Terry Moore. They came along later on in the 1930s. But I think that really helped establish the mystique of Cardinal baseball.
Do you have a favorite Cardinal team of all time? We all usually have one team that we kind of attach to that for whatever reason hooks us in and is special to us. And you've seen pretty much all the great ones. Do you have a favorite? I'm sure that's a tough call to make.
Yeah, that's a tough one because you have to go back to the pennant years and or followed by the World Series years. But I guess what sticks in my mind most was the 1942 team because that's the one that upset the Yanks in five games. And that in that particular World Series, the only game I saw was the first game, and that was the only game we lost in the series. But I think that because it was the first World Series game I saw and the first and we happened to win that World Series, that resonates.
Jim, it's been a lot of fun to have you today. I think we'll end out on this question, and that is, if you have to think, you know, about all your years of being a season ticket holder and attending games, a Cardinal fan, whether it's something that you witnessed at one of the three ballparks, maybe not even a monumental moment in franchise history, but something that was special to you, or whether it was a player, like you talked about seeing Ted Williams and all those great Cardinals, or maybe just a theme or an idea, but is there one thing that you hold tightest that matters most to you from your Cardinal fanship? If you had to pick something,
Brett, are you talking about a play, a particular play?
Sure, a play or just a memory at the ballpark, an experience maybe.
Well,
with
both
someone.
A play and a memory at the ballpark. Never would forget Ozzie's home run.
1985, I presume, game
right.
Number five?
Right, which projected us into the series that year. That's the one. I even get chills thinking about it. Being here and watching that, watching Ozzie circle the bases that day, it was incredible. He's not a Hall of Famer because of the number of home runs he hit, for gosh sakes. He did everything else superbly, but that was a winner. That was a Cardinal winner and a big turning point, and that's perhaps the decisive turning point in that season.
Perhaps maybe one of the most eloquently and perfectly described plays, too. It really was corked down the line. What an apt word by Jack Buck.
Right. It wasn't even close. I mean, when it left his bat, you knew it was leaving the park. It was not a cheap home run.
And then he went down into the tunnel, and we so often hear that clip or see that little piece of video, but he went down into the tunnel, and then he came back out for a curtain call after the game was done, didn't he?
Oh, I'm sure that he did, yeah.
It's a special night, and of course, the very next game, Jack Clark hit a home run in Los Angeles, too, which that was a pretty special moment and a pretty special season.
Right, it was. And versus the Dodgers, was that one?
That's correct.
Yeah. And I think I think the Dodgers manager left the pitcher in for one too many batters, as I recall, if that's the way it really worked out. But yeah, Clark was a great addition to our club.
Well, I love that. Ozzie in 85, a favorite moment, I think, for a lot of folks.
Yes.
Jim, it's been a pleasure. We appreciate you being a season ticket holder and coming and telling us a little bit about all these years and all these decades of Cardinal baseball. Sincerely, it's been fun for me. I've always said that if I could do anything or step back in time to anything, I think I'd go see a game at Sportsman's Park. So I enjoy you painting a little bit of a picture for us today. Thanks for joining us.
And thank you very much. It was I was pleased to be here. I'm honored to be on the program with you today. Thanks.
if you're a St. Louisan like me, how cool is that? Used to go on the streetcar to the games at Grand and Doty, or what was once Sportsman's Park and then eventually renamed Busch Stadium after the brewery bought the team back in the 50s. The streetcar, I think that is one of my favorite parts of our talk with Jim Shealy. Again, just a neat gentleman, some neat recollections. We really do appreciate his time. Over this past weekend, and again, as I talk to you here, you're probably listening at the earliest on May the 8th, and I'm talking to you here as I sit on May the 7th, but Albert Pujols just collected his 3,000th career hit for the Los Angeles Angels in Seattle a couple of days ago, and that got the old highlights out of Albert doing what he did for that decade here in St. Louis. And I heard the home run call for his 1,000th hit on April the 21st, 2006. And I just got the nostalgia. I got the feels a little bit when I heard it. And I thought that you would like to hear it too. Here's how Mike Shannon called that 1,000th hit for Albert on the Cardinals Radio Network.
Swing, and it's 2-0 Cardinal. Look at this baby ride. Get up, get up, get up. Oh, yeah. It's over the wall. And the Redbirds lead 2-0 on Albert's 11th of the year. And you can hang some words on that, baby.
That's his fourth home run in as many at-bats in this ballpark, Mike.
He just keeps on rolling. He hit three in a row. And that was on Sunday. We left, went to Pittsburgh. He hit one the first time up there. Whew, I don't know what Albert's eating, but keep feeding it to him. And this crowd, sellout crowd, on their feet. Woo!
If you lived through those years, and if you're listening, you most likely did as a Cardinal fan, you saw Albert play in person. There were a lot of great memories. Of course, he's in Anaheim now with the Los Angeles Angels, and we wish him all the best as he continues to chase milestones. But I think it was fun for a lot of people in St. Louis and to see that hit, and I know that I enjoyed it as a guy who grew up coming to games and watching Albert put together just 10 magnificent years in a Redbird uniform. So congratulations to Albert on 3,000. One of just four people in baseball history to have 3,000 hits and 600 home runs. He joins just Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, and Alex Rodriguez to have that distinction. It's been a special career for Albert. A lot of fun the other day to see him get to that 3K mark. Speaking of special, we are celebrating Bob Gibson this year. 50 years since the 1.12 ERA in 1968. We've got our Complete Gamer campaign. I know I've mentioned it before on the podcast. And Cardinals Magazine did a really neat article that comes out in their next issue. It is both print, I believe, and some photos of what's going on, Bob's, you know, recollection of that 1968 season. So we wanted to get Stan on the podcast, Stan McNeil, the senior writer for Cardinals Game Day Magazine. Wanted to get him on the podcast, as we do every time a new issue has either just dropped or about to drop, and he talks things over with Ben Holtmeyer. So I'll hand it over to those guys. It's Stan McNeil and Ben Holtmeyer. Go for it, fellas, on the Cardinals Insider Podcast.
Thanks, Brett. Ben Holtmeyer here. And again, we're talking Cardinals Magazine with senior writer of the magazine, Stan McNeil. And this is kind of starting to be a running thing. Now we're talking about Bob Gibson and about his 50th anniversary of his incredible season of 1968. And this magazine, issue 2 so far for this year, really hits this home. And it's a unique story that dives into pictures that Bob Gibson talks about. Stan, do you want to kind of allude to what the story is about? And then how did you get the idea for doing pictures and having Bob Gibson sit down and kind of illustrate these for you?
Well, obviously 1968, this being the golden anniversary of 112, there's going to be a lot of focus on Bob Gibson from the Cardinals this year, rightfully so, and I hope people really appreciate it and don't take it for granted just because he's still around here sometimes. I mean, what he did that year in his entire career is truly, truly remarkable. The idea for this story actually is something we picked up. I think the first time we did it was with Lou Brock a couple of years ago. You know, I mean, these guys have had so much written about them that it's kind of neat to take a different tact and just sit down with, you know, a dozen photographs that kind of illustrate their career and get them to kind of talk about that particular moment. So it worked well with Lou, it worked well with Whitey, and I think it worked just as well with Bob.
And you kind of had to reel him in a little bit. I hear in the story that It was over Cabernet and dinner, correct?
Well, that was part of it, but Bob doesn't, he's not big on interviews, as most people know, but he does kind of look out for the Cardinals. You know, this being Cardinals magazine, I think, I don't know if he felt a responsibility or an obligation, but it definitely helped, you know. I mean, it, I think that he was certainly willing, and, you know, we spent about 3 hours together, and I think we had a very nice bottle of Cabernet that he enjoyed and enjoyed as well, and I think that might have kept us there a little bit longer, but definitely was a fun interview.
That's really cool, and you talk about not taking him for granted. The stat that sticks out to me that's just unfathomable, and that's how he has more complete games than wins. Like, if you just start rooting for the game now, say you're a much younger version of myself here, so you're like 14, 15 getting into the game, you wouldn't be even able to understand or comprehend that fact.
Yeah, and definitely the game has changed, and we don't see complete games like we saw them 10, 20 years ago. But even in his era, his complete games were pretty much an incredible stat. I mean, in 68, the year that he put up the 1-1-2 and went 22-9, he pitched 28 complete games. He never went less than seven innings a start. And that included the three starts he made in the World Series. So I think he made 37 starts that year, all of them at least seven innings with 28 complete games. And that really wasn't – he had 28 complete games the next year as well. So while it was an incredible season, it was kind of the norm for him.
And that's the most ridiculous part, is that that was the norm.
You know, year after year, because obviously everybody wants to know what clicked in 68, what made 68 so much, you know, such a historic season. And his answer is pretty simple, but it's pretty, you know, but it's fairly obvious, is that he had kind of built up to that. You know, I mean, if you look at his wins totals, and this was a time when, at least for Gibson, wins were what mattered in terms of his salary. So he was, that's what he was after. And his wins went up about five straight years until 1967. And they were going up that year. That was the year that he broke his leg on Roberto Clemente, hit a line drive off his leg.
That's one of the stories in there.
He pitched, stayed in the game for three more batters. The leg just popped. He missed 7.5 weeks, came back in early September, won some games in September, then won three complete games in the World Series. So, you know, you could say 67 was almost as incredible as 68, and it was in its own way.
I have my favorite. I was looking through each one of these. It's a picture that basically describes a part of Bob Gibson's career, whether it's his 3,000 strikeout or a no-hitter. And what was your favorite one of these that you got to hear about?
Oh, I think it would have to be the one where he was a TV announcer.
Hmm.
After he retired, he worked on Monday Night Baseball as an analyst for a couple of years. And as we're talking about this, I learned that he did basketball announcing during his playing days. That was kind of his off-season job for a couple of years in the late 60s, early 70s, somewhere in there. He did the ABA. I think they were the New York Nets at that time. The New York Nets, he was like the color commentator on New York Nets basketball. So it was fun, you know, and he will tell you to this day that basketball was his favorite sport to play growing up, and he set scoring records at Creighton University where he played. He played for the Globetrotters for a full Globetrotter season, and it was only after that when the Cardinals were able to give him a little financial incentive to give up basketball and focus just on baseball.
You talk about Creighton and the Omaha kind of a relation. That's still his home, correct?
He was born there, went to high school there, went to college there, lived there every offseason when he was playing with the Cardinals, and lives there today. I mean, he had a restaurant in Omaha for a while, was part owner of a radio station for a while. And, yeah, he just I don't know if it's – I mean, obviously it's near and dear to his heart now, but I think he was willing to move. He told me that they looked into moving to St. Louis, you know, in the early 60s, but at that time, because of the racial division was still enough, mm-hmm. that he just didn't feel comfortable enough to move from Omaha to do that.
Kind of staying on that frame of mind here with the Cardinals have also released that campaign this year, Complete Gamer. And you were just kind of talking about that mentality. How cool is that to tie in with the song and the campaign and this story and the whole year? How, just kind of describe that feeling for Bob Gibson and what this is like for him.
Yeah, I mean, well, for Gibson, for Bob, I'm not sure. He doesn't get too emotional
right.
about things. I mean, and when you think about it, well, he has accomplished a lot, and it would take a lot to really get him excited. But for me, I think it's a great campaign. I think any way we can kind of bring to the youth, to younger baseball fans, what this guy meant to the game, to the Cardinals, to everything, just how dominant he was. I mean, we see him on opening day. We see him at the Cardinals Hall of Fame induction ceremonies. We see him around, and he's 82. He still looks good. It looks like he could still throw some batting
Absolutely.
Practice out there. But I just hope that people really kind of take a little time and look and see what this guy accomplished, because from his era, from 59 to 75, he led the major leagues in wins. He led the major leagues in complete games and shutouts in a lot of different categories. He was the best, not only the greatest pitcher in Cardinals history, but he was the best pitcher, for my money, from the era that he played in.
Just a couple more. You talk about dominance. It kind of, I guess it's kind of an arguable topic here, is that after that magical season, they lowered the mound. He basically changed the sport.
Yeah, I mean, I compare that to Wilt Chamberlain was responsible for the widening of the key in basketball.
Yep.
It's the same kind of thing. And he'll say, well, it wasn't just me, and there were a lot of great pitching performances in 68, but no one put up a 1.12 ERA. No one won 15 games in a row that year. And this is, to me, this is pretty amazing stat. Within that 15-game winning streak, there was a stretch where he made 11 starts, pitched 11 complete games, and allowed 3 runs total in that 11-game stretch. I mean, you think 11 complete games, it's been years since a pitcher threw 11 complete games in a season, much less in a 2-month period.
And then giving up only three runs. There's some shutouts mixed in there.
And then the thing about that is, I know at least two of those came with two outs. One of them came on it was against the Dodgers. It was when he had his shutout scoreless inning streak going. And it's debatable whether it was a wild pitch or a pass ball as to whether that run scored. And then there was another run that scored on a double down the left field line with two outs. Bobby Tolan, I believe, was the left fielder who later said that he should have made that catch. So you're talking about three runs, and two of them could have been easily prevented.
Last one. This story in this magazine, it's really kind of a Cardinals keepsake when you're talking about just the history of the Cardinals, baseball, and Bob Gibson. And a lot of this is pretty rare to hear, and that's stuff that we might not ever hear again. Who knows? And so I think that this is a really kind of unique deal. Would you agree with that?
It is, and it's kind of a two-part package, because coming later this summer will be the 2018 Cardinals yearbook, and Bob is going to be the focus of that, whereas the magazine feature kind of looks at his career, the yearbook will focus more on 68, the year of the pitcher, with a heavy focus on Bob. So there'll be a long Q&A in that we got at the same interview when we talked about the photos.
That's great. So there's more Bob Gibson to come all season long.
And really take the time to enjoy it, because it really is worth it.
Well, thanks, Stan. Again, fans, if you guys are interested in getting a subscription for Cardinals Magazine, you can do that online, or you can call the Cardinals ticket office. That number is 314-345-9000. You can do it online at cardinals.com/magazine. You can get a full subscription right there. You can also find out more at cardinals.com/publications. Thanks, Dan. I'm Ben Holtmeyer. Brett, it's all yours.
Thank you, Ben. Ben mentioned where you can pick up that new issue of the magazine as it drops, and want to remind you can also get it where they sell the scorecards, those red stands across the ballpark down here in St. Louis, and then also local grocers across the St. Louis metro area. I want to call all soccer fans. Soccer Night returns to Busch Stadium. That's Thursday, May 17th. You purchase a special theme ticket, you receive an exclusive St. Louis Cardinals soccer jersey. Get your soccer night tickets at cardinals.com/theme. I've got a tip of the cap to the promo and ticket folks. That's a great theme night in this city. It's a baseball town, but it's a great sports town, and it's an all-time great soccer town in the United States, and the jersey is really cool. I'm not personally a huge soccer guy, but I saw the ad the other day, and I thought, man, I wouldn't mind having one of those. It's pretty neat looking. So if you feel the same way, and there's a lot of us here in St. Louis that are big soccer fans, if you're one of those, then head on over to cardinals.com/theme, whether you want to be here for soccer night or whether you just think the threads look cool. Either way, cardinals.com/theme is where you can go ahead and get your ticket. Next week, we're looking back on the summer of 1998. I just had a big TV story that went out this past Sunday, actually, as I speak to you now. It was on Mark McGwire and a look at that 98 season through the eyes of people who were behind the scenes, maybe people that you haven't heard of or you maybe are familiar with the name, but you don't hear from them a lot in the media. And it was a neat dive and some great stories from that summer. I mean, the kind of things that just make you go, wow, that is cool. The things that hearken you back to that day and age and help you to really remember how it made you feel when it was happening. It was such a cool summer. I really enjoyed the TV story. If you want to see that, you can go to cardinals.com/video. Just type in McGwire. It should pop up. But we're going to bring you some full audio from that next week here on the podcast. It's John Vooch, who works in baseball operations for the Cardinals. Vicki Bryant, she is the VP of merchandising for the Cardinals. So there was a lot there because obviously souvenirs were a big deal that summer. All of us owned something McGwire-related from 98 probably. And then also Dan McLaughlin, who wasn't in his current post but was doing feature stories for Cardinal TV. He weighs in on what that summer was like, and Dan, as always, is the man. He's got a great perspective and is a great historian and just a guy that treasures Cardinal history really well. So all three of them were a pleasure to talk to. All three of them had really, truly unique insights. I encourage you to make sure that you are subscribed next week. If you aren't subscribed and you want to make sure you don't miss the episode, or maybe you want to hear from Ben Hochman on his new book, we talked to him last week. All of our episodes are available at iTunes. Just search Cardinals Insider or cardinals.com/podcast. You can subscribe and listen to old episodes there as well. And if you want to get in touch with me, I really do read every last email, podcast@cardinals.com. If you shoot me a note, I make sure to always get back to you. Sometimes it might take me a couple of days just because it's a separate inbox on my computer, so I sometimes forget to look daily. But I do check it at least once a week, so I will get back to you and love hearing from you if you are a regular listener. Thanks so much to Jim Shealy, to Stan McNeil, to Ben Holtmeyer. We appreciate everybody being involved with the program today. We will talk to you next Tuesday. Every Tuesday during the baseball season, there's a new episode. We're talking about the summer of 98 next week, but until then, my name is Brett McMillan. Thanks for listening to the Cardinals Insider Podcast.